descent.
Great. So we're rolling.
Yep. Great. All right. Well, oh,
there she is, Loki.
Hi.
Excellent timing.
Yes. I was paying attention. I knew this.
Excellent. Well, we were actually just about to get started, and so everybody knows who's here. Right now we have on the phone Michael, staff attorney from our office, and Don Brayman. And those of you on the phone, we now have Kate Mitchell, Dave, Laura, and Katya in the room. Again, we're expecting, hopefully, Renata will be joining us, but she might call in, she might be in person, she might be delayed. Paul Butler also emailed me, and he hopes to join as soon as he can here. So Kate, particularly for sort of kind of know our setup here, we do record the meetings, welcome. I mean, we're sorry to not have Chanel be sitting in with us, but I'm sure you're.
We did see the job
swamped.
Announcement. Though.
Good. Anyone you know, send them our way.
Well, let me think. Few reminders. So, I think as you all know, any written comments on property offense reports are due this Friday. By midnight is fine for those who are. The next thing we're going to be issuing, and it'll be issued next week, hopefully early part of the week, is some draft recommendations for conspiracy. And you know, it is both kind of a lengthy commentary because, like some of the other inchoate offenses, it's just, you know, our law in the district is all over the place. And so trying to herd those cats takes a little bit of explaining, but the actual language itself, very short in the end. So that will be out next week. I expect that'll be about a 5-week, 6-week turnaround, so mid-December, in other words, asking for comments back on that. Depends a little bit how quickly we get it out here next week. Staff, we're working on assault, threats, robbery, with murder and sex abuse on the horizon. So, again, just want to encourage anybody, if you have initial thoughts or recommendations that you want to talk about, we're happy to meet in person or by email, whatever way you wish. But you know, as we're putting together those initial drafts, if you have concerns or let us know. Otherwise, you know, those will be issued after conspiracy. We'll see the exact timing of that, but most likely in January, February.
Do you have the date of the December meeting?
Yes. So the next meeting is going to be Wednesday, December 6th. And again, I want to make sure it's 3 to 5 in everybody's calendars. There was a little bit of confusion. So 3 to 5, Wednesday, December 6th. And then come the new year, we start on, you know, the different schedules. So Wednesdays, the first one will be January 3rd from 10 to 12 in the morning. Let's see. Last thing I wanted to mention, we will sooner than later, hopefully in the next month or so, be able to issue kind of a basic set of data that we have via the court on frequencies of charging and convictions for adults in Superior Court, both misdemeanor and felony. We have a lot of that data. We've analyzed some of it. We were trying to get some slight tweaks to that from the court, so that's the resulting delay. But if anybody has like particular questions, data-related questions, feel free to ask me. It may be something we can address now, or it may be like kind of say you have to. We're just not there yet, so you need to wait a bit. But hopefully, we'll have kind of an across-the-board set of data on at least basic frequencies here within a month. Also with that, hopefully some more details on co-charges in the same case, and some other kind of maybe even graphics on distribution of sentences. We're still working it through. So, all right. All that said, good. I just open it up. I mean, frankly, Laura and Dave, you two have been the most generative of comments so far. So I look forward to it. And I will say for everybody, you know, like, so we've been keeping kind of some rolling lists. You know, obviously, you know, everything from, you know, typos to bigger substantive points, everything's welcome. Again, either orally, you know, just drop me an email. We will take note of it if it's obviously, if it's something so we just need. That's a great way. If, you know, but, you know, for your formal written comments, anything that's like a larger point particularly or like more of a policy-based point, you know, please do mention it in the written comments. We'll, you know, we're going to, there's a lot in the mix, so we're going to do our best to make sure we keep track of everything. I may come back to you with follow-up. We've got various note-taking systems, but we want to make sure we don't drop the ball on anything. So,
and just so you guys know, I actually took them up on that with the people last week to give them a list of technical stuff, non-controversial stuff. So
Well,
my memo will be maybe a little shorter than previous memos. We'll see.
You know, I don't know what to expect from everybody, and I never do. So I'm open to surprises. Great. Well, again, Laura, you had emailed me about this one matter. I want to make sure to remind you about the material.
That was what I was raising my hand for.
Is that where you're going
to
first?
I do, however, also have another matter. But
okay.
I'll ask my material. No, I better ask the other one or I'll forget it.
Okay.
Because together we're going to remember the material.
Okay.
Right, the other one, which I've already forgotten, is, oh, yeah, so it had to do with, it's another list. And it's one that you've said, Dave, was unequal, but we were reacting to different things. I had a problem with a different part.
Which offense?
Well, it's on the offense. Oh. I'm getting there. It'll be exciting when I get there. Ah! Deceive and deception. So my question is about D. I switched my glasses so that I could see you all, see up there. But now, of course, I can't read my paper. So my issue is D is different. It doesn't require something to be material. It doesn't require a false impression. It sort of has no negative thing in it. It's just failing to disclose a known lien. And my question is whether there is some freestanding legal obligation of the buyer to say to the seller, you know, there's a lien or there's an adverse claim. Because to me, this reads as a strict liability thing piece, unlike all the other pieces, where I'm selling you my house and I know you know because you're sitting there with a copy of it and I don't tell you. And the way this reads, and I sort of remember making a note saying, see how this ends up playing out. And I did keep track of it, and I didn't feel better when I did finally get there. Now, so it seems to me it's either one of two things. It is, there is a freestanding legal obligation that I'm supposed to tell you, and therefore this is a criminal enforcement of my failure to do that freestanding. When you sell property, you better disclose liens, in which case this should be modified to say that I didn't perform the legal duty. Mm-hmm. Or I think it should be that I fail to disclose something I know you don't know, in the same way that the others are about the buyer or the other person has a false impression or something, that I'm taking advantage as opposed to just an omission that, quite frankly, may have zero harm whatsoever. So my question is whether it's freestanding. There's some, what's this about?
So, yes, all right. So, this is included in the NPC in almost every jurisdiction that does codify a deception definition. So in large part, this is sort of going with the national norm. As far as the materiality, right, there's no explicit materiality within this definition, though hard to imagine liens or adverse claims that would be immaterial. As the mental...
Immaterial.
Immaterial. Immaterial. as the mental states, the deceived definition and deception definition itself doesn't include a mental state. Thinking being that...
True, but it does have negative behavior, right? It is about a false impression of a material fact. Preventing another person certainly is negative, right? Failing to correct a false impression. I mean, it is, it's not a mental, so I don't want to inject a mental state. I want to be sensitive to that. On the other hand, this doesn't fit with the others as far as I'm concerned.
Sure, I mean, that's true. So generally, for the most part, with deception, it's going to require some affirmative act. There really isn't a duty to inform anyone of anything. And this is just one of the sort of few exceptions in the context of real estate transactions where, again, it depends how you would define the offense. We could apply, though, a knowing standard, which is what we've done with the fraud offense, and that you would have to knowingly deceive someone, and that if you're going to try to prove deceit under D, that it would have to be, you wouldn't have to, you know, it wouldn't be a strict liability offense necessarily the way that you were concerned with.
So it works into effective consent, right? So I knowingly.
Well, not by deception, right?
So I sell you a property.
This isn't effective. No, okay, go ahead.
I'm selling you a property.
Right.
And there is, in fact, an adverse claim on it, right? It's not required that I lie to you and say, and by the way, this property is unencumbered. Free, clear title, buy it, you rely on that. It would be enough that I knew of an adverse claim or lien and just failed to disclose that to you. So what's doing the work here
that's supposed to maybe make me feel better is that the consent being obtained by deception? So this is you. I'm going to make you the alleged criminal,
sure.
But that's fine because Concha will be your lawyer. So you're in good hands. So you knowingly take my money.
Right.
To exercise control over the property of another, my money, mm-hmm. with my consent, and I say, sure, you can have it. The consent being obtained by deception. You knowingly get my consent by deception.
Right.
So you have to... But again, you know that you haven't told me, but you also know that I already know.
So this is the case in which you know of the lien yourself?
I already know of it, right.
To additionally disclose it?
Other than
being disclosed to you.
If she's independently knows, she looked
because,
up the title.
Exactly. I don't know when I'm supposed to have found out or when this
Rob, you found out
is,
independently.
But right, somebody else
anyway.
Had the property or something. It's listed that way in the first place or something by some previous agent or something.
So
you know that I know.
Can I one thing? So I just want to make sure that the context for this is fraud and really only fraud, right? So while deception shows up in the definition of effective consent, it's by exclusion there, right? So it's, you know, other places, this isn't applying. Fraud, you know, even for our fraud type offenses, all the other versions, you know, payment card fraud, check fraud, forgery, hard to imagine any of these in a real estate transaction, really, except
that would implicate this form of deception.
That's right. So,
not forgery?
Well, maybe.
Maybe forgery, but not ID theft.
Right.
So you say it's used in fraud and forgery. So, yes.
So, and in those contexts, for the elements where it's coming up is that the consent being obtained by deception, right? And knowingly obtaining the consent by deception. So the person would have to know that your consent to this transaction is because of a but-for cause of your giving the consent.
Because he failed to disclose.
That you would have to be aware to a practical certainty that it was that failure which made this deal go through, right? So in other words, it has, it's causal in the sense of being, this is a but-for reason for you doing this. I would have to know that you would not have engaged in this transaction if you had been aware of the lien, etc.
And what's doing that work?
So
this is recorded, right? So we have this meeting, but we are going to be able to come back to this moment where you are definitely going to lose on the factual question of you didn't tell me, okay?
Well,
I'm also going to lose on the fact that I've got a piece of paper here that's like adverse claim on blah blah blah. I know.
Losing the sense that there would be no liability in the context
of... You didn't disclose it.
But you already knew.
But here it is. It will also... I will not be able to say I didn't know because it turns out it's right here on this piece of paper. So now what do we have doing the work?
Well, then there was no consent obtained by deception.
That's my question.
Right.
Why? Because deception is failing to disclose. And
right, but that wasn't
disclose.
How. Right, but that's not how I obtained your consent
so,
to give over.
Okay, so what's doing the work is the consent being obtained by deception.
Yeah,
being
yeah.
obtained by failing to disclose. That's
right.
What's doing the work.
Right.
Do I feel okay about that? That seems like
is
a
that,
lot of work.
Can people still see the screen? Maybe
well,
a little
no,
better.
No, it's between my eyes. Okay, I know that's my problem.
Yeah, just make sure, yeah, we're on the same page there. So right, the knowingly applies to the fact that the consent is being obtained by deception. So, right.
It's not really that you consented and I happened to deceive you in some way as defined.
As you were saying, kind of as a technical matter, oh, whoops, I forgot
right.
to disclose this, you know, in the transaction as a separate,
not,
you know,
right.
regulatory
and it
matter.
It mattered because you already knew about this lien anyway, apparently independently, regardless of whether I knew that, right? In that case, you're consenting regardless, so it's not obtained by these particular means. Even though I otherwise maybe would have satisfied that definition of deception. Is that...
Right, I mean, it could be an attempt, right? Like, if the person thinks and believes that they're obtaining it by deception, but in fact it's not obtained by deception, that would arguably be attempted fraud.
There's that.
All right, well...
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not sure I'm happy. But maybe what it is, or at least maybe this is explained, right? Mm-hmm. It's not... It really did strike me when I first read it as really different.
Yeah,
it is.
We can definitely.
Yeah, it is.
And so the work is going to be.
Yeah.
It's not just that you failed to disclose,
yeah.
but that you were.
Right, but that comes from the interplay of putting the definition in there. When now we've got the mental state knowingly applies.
It's like knowingly failing to disclose.
No,
it
but you would say
be.
The consent is being obtained by failing to disclose.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in your example, you're not obtaining the consent by the failure to disclose.
Right.
So it's a substitution.
I will say, you know, it's. I think the reason this is like hardwired in, even though it does seem somewhat duplicative of some of the others, is that it's a. All this stuff is fairly infrequent, but like this comes up, and so they wanted a specific provision to deal with it, and we can definitely try to tweak the commentary on this at the very least to kind of make clear that right this isn't talking about some other regulatory duty, and we could even add something in mm-hmm. even in the definition section, but certainly in the fraud section,
yeah.
kind of noting that again it's. This notion that it's causal in the sense it's the
right,
deception
right,
which
right,
is yeah
right,
so
right,
so,
yes.
so we can clarify kind of what we've been explaining also more in the commentary if that'd be helpful.
Sure.
All right.
Do you have anything else on fraud? Or
anything else?
I don't have anything else on fraud. I have my other thing. But
I had one little thing on fraud.
Or on deception.
What do you want to go? Or are you still?
I had a completely separate thing. I'm happy to give you.
I just had one comment that I told him about in fraud.
Okay.
And I told you guys about this, but just so everybody else knows, you knowingly take, obtain, transfer,
mm-hmm.
or exercise control, and I don't believe that that what you would actually be doing is transferring within the transfer statute, but what the person would be doing is causing the transfer, because the transfer implies that the defendant actually possessed it in some manner before he's transferring it, but the fraud makes clear that it doesn't have to be me who has it. I can cause Rich to send it to you, and that's fraud. And by saying transfer, it sort of puts me in the middle of it.
More of an active role.
Of an active role.
Right.
Of a more active role.
More active.
So my suggestion was to put that as causes the transfer,
yeah.
because that's what I'm doing.
Yeah, and our intent was definitely to cover that
type of act.
Type right. of conduct.
Right.
So it's this is a drafting question, and it's one that goes throughout, you know, this... this list is a much shortened version of the general longer laundry list that's in FAFSA, and you know.
That's right.
So honestly, we've recently had some conversations too about maybe whether we can shorten this further, or looking at this this short laundry list anyway. So yes, we'll take a look at that and try to clarify this, like the causal, you know, aspect. Even if, again, you're not the one directly taking it, if you're causing somebody to take it, right?
Yeah.
Sufficient.
So, however you,
so
that,
good.
To me, that was a pure drafting issue, but I don't want to lose the concept.
Yeah. No, it's yeah. Good.
Material.
So, okay.
So this is. Material is used in a number of places. My question, and just for the record, I'll say I sent Richard an email more because I was worried I would forget by the time we got to this moment, and I was like, help me remember. And so the question is, how is material defined, and is it an objective standard? So what I reacted to, although it's used in a number of places, was the definition of coercion, the last one, perform any other act that's calculated to cause material harm to another person's health, safety, business, career, reputation, or personal relationship. The explanation.
So it's under coercion, or?
That was coercion. Yeah. So this is chapter, report number 8. And at page 10, it talks about conduct such as threatening to lower a student's grade. Is intended, to change the verb, and they really gave some other examples, to fall within this provision, this catch-all. And as the mother of a child who loses her mind over every little grade, even the stupid little quiz grade, threaten to lower that is material. But, like, it's a quiz grade, and, like, who cares? So my question, so coming from that silly place, was this question of if the person who threatens it is like, that is not a big deal, it's a quiz grade, but the helicopter parent and overachieving ridiculous child is like, it's a quiz grade, is it material? And the rest of it was, so then it was, is it possible that part of the definition is in some way it is, or the objective part of it has to have some hope of achieving the thing, right? I'm going to lower your quiz grade if you don't give me $50. Yeah. That, like, that's either a real thing or so unbelievably stupid it's not material. Yeah. But how is that?
Bryson, did you want to actually jump in this first? Because this largely, the coercion, actually, at least here, we can talk about other places where material comes up, but for extortion, which is kind of like the core offense where this would come up, right, it's again, you're getting money in exchange for, or by coercion. So.
Yeah, exactly. No, so I think it's a good question. I think to answer it directly, I mean, when I drafted this, intended it to be some sort of an objective standard, right? It's not going to depend on the particularities of the victim, like your kid who feels very sensitive about his or her grade. And then to kind of fill in some background about where this provision came from, the Model Penal Code's definition of it's not a definition of coercion, they just list all these things basically in their extortion statute, but it's functionally equivalent. They have language that's basically inflict any other harm which would not benefit the person making the threat or suggestion. And if you read the model penal commentary, they're saying, we have all these like sorts of threats that you can make against a person in order to obtain their property, but the kinds of threats that people can come up with in order to extort people are so diverse and so like there's such a broad variety of stuff out there that you can use to leverage someone into giving you their property that we want to include what they call a residual clause. And so that's the function that Jay is playing is supposed to be that residual clause where one of the many other kinds of threats you can make won't satisfy the defendant's behavior, but it's still kind of wrongful and bad. But the problem with that, of course, is that if you do, or at least our thought was, if you do with the Model Penal Code and said inflict any other harm, which would not benefit the person making the threat or suggestion, you're expanding it to, I mean, that's actually probably quite broader than what we necessarily want. So after the
can I jump in and just say, so the Model Penal Code also has this de minimis provision regarding de minimis conduct, which kind of just sweeps away the kind of super trivial, you know, right, not even a quiz, but like, I will frown at you. You know, I will frown the next time I see your parents. Or, you know, like, the imagine whatever the lightest form of negative act that would be coercive to a particular kid or person. Does that qualify? Well, again, they just have this general de minimis conduct.
What does that mean? It's like a freestanding?
Yeah, it's in the general part, and it goes to things like, it goes to things like assault. It goes to things like, you know, where we would say, you know, in the district under, you know, kind of, you know,
like,
yeah, exactly. You know, exactly.
Yeah, it empowers the court on its own to dismiss based upon a statement of reason, a charge, you know, for considering a variety of factors, but all of which go to either minimal blameworthiness or minimal harm at issue in any given aspect of conduct.
So given that, so that gives some context for why the Model Penal Code wasn't afraid about, like, lowering the floor all the way down in its writing of, like, its extortion statute, because it had this other provision that kind of says, separately, we're going to, the really trivial conduct we can brush aside with this other de minimis provision. Since we don't have that kind of de minimis provision, that's why we wanted to, like, be a little more careful about the floor here, but to also have it go low, right? Like, this is, you know, the catch-all. So that was, I think, kind of the extent of our, like, I don't, and we could certainly happy to have kind of a discussion more about what that should be or whether more content should be given to what material means, but the thought was, you know, right, to just put some marker there for courts and judges to kind of say there is some level of behavior that is too low. And, you know, what that is, hard to say. I guess the other thing we talked about, you know, taking an objective standard, you could take a subjective from the point of view of the complainant. The other option is to take a subjective from the point of view of the defendant, right? So, you know, perform any other act that is calculated. The calculated part here, you know, if it was intended, essentially, to cause material harm, right? You know, maybe that is another perspective to take, that if the defendant, you know, knew that, well, fine, your child is super sensitive about this, and was using that to extort money or whatever else, you know, that might be effective. So maybe that's one way to frame how one addresses whether it was a material harm. Was it intended as such?
So Richard, the only other thing I would point out is just that the knowledge mental state does carry through, right? In the same way that it did with fraud. Prong four of extortion is the consent being obtained by coercion, so the knowingly would travel that. So it seems like it would already be, in some sense, there would have to be some level of awareness on behalf of the defendant concerning the materiality of harm if you were to carry the knowingly mental state through in the same way.
Right. And I'm sorry, let me interrupt. Did somebody join us then?
I think we have two Dons on the line. So.
Oh, okay. Don number one, Don number two. Okay.
I'll add the other states that don't strictly. So first of all, a few states actually follow the Model Penal Code. Do that any? And I think actually a few states codify the de minimis provision as well.
That's
probably explains why they're doing it. The alternative word to use is substantial or substantial.
I don't have a problem with material, and I'll think about it in other contexts. I guess what I'll suggest, and I can put it in my comments. Perhaps let's not have an explanation that is so close to potentially being de minimis. So maybe the knowing and the calculated really will end up doing the work, and for someone it may be a quiz grade and we whatever, but maybe we don't already start so low. I mean, even if it was final grade or course grade or it's not, or we don't use that example at all, but something that seems a little more substantial and isn't so easy for someone like me to fill in and go.
We could do an example that's like a clearer, like kind of safe harbor, this is definitely covered, and then a clearer one that is like definitely not covered, and leave it at that to like where in between those. Okay, yeah, we can step at that.
Where is, can you guys remind me what coercion is used?
Sure. So extortion is the main, I'll pull it up.
Extortion and financial exploitation of an adult is what it says on page 9.
Let me just flip to extortion. Just have never mind. I got it.
You got it?
Yeah, no, I had read it one way, just misread it when Laura was talking. And
okay.
And back to where I was going. That's really good.
Good. Well, anything else on this point then? Or does that kind of, okay, get your...
Some fraud, I don't know if it's pulling that, but also in fraud context, it is also an objective standard kind of misrepresentation that would affect a reasonable person's decision.
Good. Other questions? That's all you got, Laura?
That's all I'm willing to share.
Right. Excellent, excellent. Well, Dave.
What do you want to start?
Yeah, exactly. We went through a lot before.
Yeah,
is there anything?
yeah. Probably the most controversial one I should bring up. Let's see. I think it's report number 8, which of course I didn't bring, about 9, 10, 11, which is the one that has, the provision, and we discussed this at the last meeting a bit, having to do with merger in which offense survives sentencing.
Okay, yep, yep.
Okay, we started on this on the last one. I'm sorry, I thought we would start with 9, but I'm not sure I talked 8 all the way through. The way that this is set up, and I think I mentioned this last time, it in my opinion, probably Chi's opinion, causes a drawn-out procedure where you can have multiple appeals taking years because you first get the first count, and the defense appeals, and they write a brief. We get court-appointed attorneys, or maybe PDS, and then we argue it. And then should they win, the second count on the list, which most severe penalty, kicks in, and then they write a second brief. That all could have happened at the same time and save the Court of Appeals and everybody a lot of time. So our proposal was to follow the court case, and I think it was Garris, where the Court of Appeals said that for merger issues, it's a lot more efficient to have... to just appeal it all at once rather than judge it at sentencing making the decision. And then after the appeal has been decided, that it would then be remanded, and then trial court can vacate the sentences. And so we were on board with the idea of not having the multiple convictions, but we proposed that as a way of accomplishing the same ends with less potential litigation. When I was writing that up for the memo, what caught me is the last sentence of paragraph C, which is provided that where there are two or more offenses subject to subsection A or B have the most severe penalty, the court may oppose a judgment conviction for any of those offenses. And then I started thinking, well, how's the court going to know? Should it be extortion or should it be one of the other ones? what is it? There's no standards. It's almost a flip of a coin on how that decision is made without any guidance, and I couldn't find anything in the commentary.
Sure.
Of course, coming from a prosecutor's office who charges the offenses and brings witnesses in and has the burden of beyond a reasonable doubt, and who may have an end game about what is to be accomplished by the convictions, we have a stake at which of those two co-equal penalty parts actually gets imposed.
Sure.
And which ones doesn't. And so I think and I just want to put it out there so basically you guys can react to it, is that what I'm going to be suggesting is that that last clause say that where there are two or more offenses subject to A and B that have the most severe penalty, that the court should impose the judgment chosen by the prosecutor as a way of resolving that ambiguity.
Okay.
So that'll be in it, just so you guys can think
when
about
should I react to that?
The memo will be fine. You can do it now. But I wanted you to have a heads up on it so you can have an opportunity to react. Because
sure.
I don't know how, I'm just trying to think of a way that when you have two equal sentences, both in a property offense category,
that's right.
You decide that.
That's right. And I mean, look, this this kind of circumstance, jurisdictions handle this very differently, right? We have voluntary sentencing guidelines, unlike a lot of jurisdictions which have presumptive guidelines and do a lot more work. Those presumptive guidelines do a lot more work in sorting this out, right? So on the other extreme, there are some jurisdictions like kind of where we are now, which it's really just kind of silent on this kind of matter, right? Really just gives broad judicial discretion to concurrent, consecutive,
in some of these offenses under current law, you would get both conviction.
Right, absolutely, absolutely. And again, it would lead to, you're not leaving.
Everyone's
on
the bus.
Okay, good. My only point is we don't have much precedent for kind of how this gets sorted out, either in the district or in other jurisdictions, but I think I haven't seen. We'll double check if what authority there might be elsewhere for kind of making this a decision up to the government. Another thing that could be done, which would be maybe not where you would want to go or where you would want to go, would be to provide some greater specificity on process here. I don't know.
A ranking.
Or some sort of required hearing of upon consideration of the government's recommendation, something that ensures that is part of the process, right? Even if it's not ultimately determinative, even if it's left up to the judge. I put that out there as a middle route to add some process to this, where there could be a hearing from both defense counsel and the government on, okay, we've got these two, we're going to merge them for purposes of sentencing. Let's hear.
More than merging, because that's what the criminal records can actually be. So it's not
that's
a
right.
merger situation.
That's right.
I wouldn't be concerned if it was the way it was under current law, because then it would be merely merger of sentencing. That's sort of the give and take of what I think the government's giving up with agreeing to the vacation.
It still stays there,
of the
right.
penalties. Yeah. Like currently under merger, it stays there, even if it's for nothing more than its record value. Mm-hmm. But under this proposal, it disappears.
I definitely hear. You have an interest in these things. In which charge ultimately prevails. I don't know how common, just as a, this is just kind of anecdotal, when you've got, kind of multiple charges, and this just depends, maybe when we start to add in penalty, assigning different gradations to penalty classes, and everybody kind of look and see, maybe it'll be clear that, third degree theft and whatever, second degree RSP or whatever, those are often going to, like, you know, be happening together, and we want to make sure in every case we're always going to want theft. It'll be clear how much this might even be an issue. I don't know how common it'll be.
And
an
we
issue.
May come. Yeah. No, I agree with you. We may come back to it and say, well, this won't come up because of the gradation. I don't know, but I just wanted to make sure that issue was preserved.
Sure. Care to respond now, Laura, or you can wait and read the full comments first and think about it too.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly don't think it's worth it for us here. I guess I want to think about it more. I mean, I sort of feel like that it's written obviously as if the prison penalty is the most important thing, and that if those are equal, then the offenses are equal. Obviously, they're not, which is why Dave is asking for his. And from our perspective, offenses aren't equal, perhaps because of collateral consequences. For example, maybe for immigration consequences or something. And I think that's valid. And something that the court could be aware of in making the decision, and maybe something either the prosecutor isn't aware of or the prosecutor doesn't care about. But I want to think about it some more, because I certainly read it as it's a discretionary call, and anybody could weigh in to say, what do you think about this when you're making that decision? As opposed to, here's the person you have to listen to
and make it. And I hear that, and I understand it. What I don't want is it being done on the paper without anything. So you get the remand from the Court of Appeals, and the next thing you know, there's a judgment. So however you decide.
Good. So it sounds like
in my memo.
It sounds like it would at least go part of the way towards your concern to write, again, have some process to be where the government and defense counsel perhaps would be heard on this matter,
or a ranking,
exactly.
So that it's true for everybody, no matter what the situation is. We always know that extortion comes before forgery or whatever.
I think it'd be hard for us to generate any recommendations or legislatively do something that kind of ranks within the same grade. I mean, like. We're gonna have
I'm just throwing out there. I'm open for suggestions if you guys got something else.
Sensing factors to be considered could be, you know, between the two.
That's true. You know. Put some factors out there for that would be essentially tiebreakers.
Right, like an interest of justice standard. No.
Well, good. Any other thoughts on this point, or move on to if that was the most controversial, Dave? I mean,
well, I figured it cheated me to say no. The rest you might go along with. I thought you'd go along with marijuana recommendations, but the prescriptions and forgery. Let me see what else. Now I'm getting into some of the more minor ones that I have in Report 9.
Okay.
One of the things I brought up at the meeting was that for criminal graffiti, the statute would require it to be visible from a public right-of-way.
And I'm
sorry, I'm on page 94 of Report Number 9, 22A2504. Yeah. And number 4 is that it is visible from a public right of way. And I understand that might have been the case of common law, but I really don't see in today's society why that should be the case for criminal graffiti. And so, like, the example that I've been using is if somebody spray paints the back of your house with the swastika or something, and they spray paint the front of your house with a swastika, the fact that it's on the front of your house versus the back of the house, as far as you, the homeowner, maybe swastika, you know, maybe you do something else, I don't know, that has less emotion to it, but that spray painted should not be the reason why criminal graffiti should be chargeable or not.
Sure.
And to the extent that it is a charge down, a plea down offense for a destruction of property, right? And you say, okay, I'd rather give you criminal graffiti because that's what I would have to charge if criminal graffiti is not available to me, right? I can't even plea it down a criminal graffiti if it's a DOP for that same spray painting, whatever. And so for those two reasons, my suggestion is removing number four.
Rachel can chime in. I think when we talk about this.
I don't know about the common law, but it's in the current statute, I do believe. And the reason that we kept it is there's been some confusing revisions to the graffiti offenses as they're currently codified in Title 22. And there's still now a definition of graffiti in like Title 45 or something that deals with abatement. And when the government can tell a homeowner to remove graffiti from their property, and I believe that is where the public right-of-way requirement comes from.
So what I would suggest then is having a conforming amendment
that separates
that from this, and that way we could address that for abatement purposes, have its own definition, and have this rise and fall. Otherwise, like I said, I don't have a plea offense to it, and it doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Sure. We can definitely take a look at that. And, you know, I think we just kind of, taken that it was in current law and the abatement as it was, so we didn't probe further about, changing those to conform with a strike of this. So, Laura, thoughts on this? Would you like to, agree with Dave that you'd like to see that go? Excellent. Okay.
Actually, I want to horse train this one. I'll agree to this if you reject that previous.
Hey, man, let's just keep it out of it. I'll go with the DOP instead.
All right. Good. Well, and again, we can have more discussion of it, but if that's something that there's definitely interest in, at the very least, we'll kind of check out how we might be able to strike that and make sure the abatement provisions and everything else gets sorted out.
All right, the next one I have is in report number 10. The offense of identity theft.
Can I ask a question before that?
Yes.
Payment card fraud. These are just questions I wrote down. I'm not saying they're smart questions. I'm not saying any of my questions ever are. So one, by use of a payment card, knowing you've changed place for property, by using a payment card, when the payment card was never issued, is that, I don't understand what that is.
Right.
The term issue, is that too?
I don't know.
Technical.
I mean,
right. So you just give some hypo for that, because this actually came up with Dave as well.
So again, so a payment card can include both a physical card, or it could be a number you enter in online, or you give over the phone if you're ordering something.
By definition.
You said
payment card is both the card and then the number description.
If I call up Pizza Parlor and I'm like, hey, here's a card, my credit card number, 123456789, whatever. They're like, okay, great. And they somehow run it and accept it.
Got lucky.
And right, so that payment card, i.e. the number, was never actually issued.
Oh.
And so that could still constitute payment card fraud.
There might be other situations too where particularly somebody at a bank or an issuer of an actual card somehow has access to, something that will work, an account number that will work, but was not actually issued by that institution. That's another possibility.
these very unusual.
Yeah, typically, like even that would probably be, you know, if it was issued to someone else or using it, it's going to fall under 2A, 2B, something like that. So 2C is really, you're using.
I guess I was thinking it was the dockless bikes, too.
I'm sorry?
You know, the dockless bikes all around the city, that's what's happening. Because they don't have an automatic debit from your account. They wait about 5 minutes before they debit. So you can make up
good to know.
prior to this being corrected. So many of them have been stolen, and they were not known to be stolen.
Interesting.
Wait, because what?
So you can type
you, like,
in whatever.
Make up a number, and it doesn't know when it releases the bike that you've just made up a number.
Correct. You just put in a 16-digit code.
How long did that go on
before they found out yesterday. Lots of the bikes are being stolen.
Yeah.
That was right up there with, remember when the Metro first opened up, people had two cards. So they went in with one, and then they went in with another one, and then they would exit from the same place using the card that they came in the morning,
sure.
Use the other card reversed, and it wasn't charging them for the any of the travel.
That
it took them about 5 years.
I was going to say, how long does it, like, you know?
Yes. Years and years.
Yeah.
And if only we collected that money, Metro would be working today. you know what I thought was where that somehow, you know, like the part where you don't call it and start it, or it didn't arrive in the mail.
Right.
That's what I thought never issued was.
Right.
I think it was a fake number.
So I think if it was again, kind of backed up maybe a step from that, like it was never officially sent, but again, like, you know, again, we have, I don't know if anybody here in the district actually issues those. I think those, you know, all these, they're coming from other places, but right, presumably somebody, PNC Bank, in-house, has access to a card that has not been sent out yet to a person, but is somehow active
but
or tied to account. That's right.
They took a blank.
Yeah,
they stamped the blank.
They misuse it and
With respect to jurisdiction.
Okay.
Before you get to jurisdiction, though, just so you know, I'm sending in a proposal that I told them about to rewrite D, so that D focuses on the person rather than switching from person to employer or contractor. So you'll see proposed language, and I'm finalizing that.
For the person's own purposes?
Yeah, that's right.
To the person because they're an employee.
For the person, and then blah, 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 rather than switching now to employee or contract, like, who are they?
Sure.
So I'll start drafting, not a substantive matter,
right,
but
right.
You guys will see that as well.
Yes.
So this maybe is a lack of imagination on my part, but with respect to jurisdiction, how is 3, the loss occurred in D.C., not 1 or 2.
So I will just say the jurisdiction
the
on this in general.
If the bank's in D.C.
What?
And they're out of the money?
The person to whom the card was issued is in D.C. Okay. The person who was the target is a resident of or is located in D.C. at the time of the fraud. But somehow the loss is in D.C., but none of the rest of us are?
I mean, it could be also like a vendor in D.C. who accepts a payment over the phone or the internet from elsewhere and suffers an economic loss here in D.C.
But she would say that's the target.
Is this not verbatim?
That's why I thought it was the bank.
This is actually,
The
bank's not the target?
No, the target is probably the guy who sells the whatever item is you're purchasing.
If I steal your credit card as a Virginia, if you're a Virginia resident, some Virginia resident's card, you know, in Virginia, and I call up to a D.C. vendor of some sort, it's unclear exactly if the target is the cardholder, the vendor who's selling the stuff. So this makes it clear that if there's that loss that occurs, or bank, right? Once you have the credit card fraud, the loss could fall in certain different places. It could fall on the card issuer, it could fall on the store who maybe has to eat the loss, or it could fall on the person who the card was legitimately issued to who maybe then has to take the loss. And
yeah,
so.
this is verbatim from current law.
Yeah.
So I hear you. We did a little bit of research into this, but since we were just tracking existing law on the jurisdiction, this is 22.32.24.01 anyway.
Okay.
So, yeah, we just didn't muddle with that.
Okay. Thank you. ID theft.
Okay. Page 36. One, on page 39, they point out that the statute has been changed to remove the provision about giving a false name to a police officer. And I understand why you did it, because it then doesn't fit in smoothly with the penalty clauses. But I think that whether if we remove it from identity theft and call it something else, that it is something that needs to maintain being criminal when you are giving false information to a police officer that then implicates that somebody else was actually the person that was committed the crime, and then there's police action that results from that, you know, whether it's a warrant that gets issued or something else that happens in a legal way. It's part of the current law, and I don't really think we should lose it. I understand why it didn't fit nicely with an identity theft, but I'd like to see a provision that, a separate provision then, that addresses that particular issue.
You bet. Sure. Definitely.
And the explanations are on 39 about falsely identifying himself at arrest,
And yes, I think we can certainly add something in the commentary to that effect of, we know some of these other overlapping offenses.
But it's not overlapping. I checked out all the places where you said it, at least in my opinion.
Okay.
It doesn't fit in there.
Yeah.
And maybe you could tweak the other places to make it fit there. But I didn't see a way that I, as the prosecutor, could argue it.
You bet. And we're projecting ahead. We kind of said, most conduct is already criminalized under these others, right? Not totally overlapping. And then all...
Which is why I don't want to lose it,
exactly,
but it's not.
Lose that sense. But yeah, are definitely, we did not, we're aware of not wanting to drop
it. Sort of specifically on the reach of the current obstruction statute and the exact sort of procedural facts of the procedure that, in your hypos you lay out, whether or not that would actually fall under... The case law is clear that obstructing is an initial investigation.
I don't think it's obstruction of justice. I don't personally don't want to see it there, and I imagine you guys don't either.
I think this is put it this way, at least from our, we have not gotten yet to reviewing obstruction of justice, but on its face, obviously, it includes conduct of many different levels of severity, from some that are obviously really damaging and serious to others that are much less serious.
But I think,
there'll have to be a lot of, obstruction of justice is going to be. It's going to take a significant amount of work, right? Maybe what we should do is we should strike the sentence and just kind of say, it will be addressed, and it needs to be addressed, and you make sure that that's in your comments, so we also preserve a record on that issue. I think, in terms of the level of conduct and making sure this kind of thing is kind of... kind of treated proportionally. It's more on the level of false statements.
That's why I wasn't particularly opposed to it being its own crime. They clearly identified that it was some sort of misidentification to a law enforcement officer, as opposed to getting convicted of obstruction of justice, which has a whole different ring to it.
Sure. Good. So again, false statements to...
I'll be interested to see what you do with it, because I think there's really different, and I certainly remember testifying on that aspect of the bill that expanded this about whether you happen to give a real person's name, whether you intend to give a real person's name.
So the culpable mental state would make a big difference on this, right? So, that makes total sense.
Dudley Do Right, I believe, is the example.
Yeah, and I don't have a problem with Dudley Do Right not getting prosecuted, but I actually had cases where a warrant was then issued, and some poor guy, he was actually, I think, a cousin of the actual person.
Right.
Nice person. And he gets handcuffed and brought out and not. There's got to be a penalty for that.
Yes, I just...
Yeah, so we can work it out. Yeah, so
even if their turns,
I think we agree. We definitely don't mean to drop this. Just hold it up. Here's the false or fictitious reports. Current statute back in Title V, which, we don't tangle much with Title V.
Yeah, did we?
But there you go. And it's, yeah, right. Make or cause to be made.
Well, the relevant clauses are further down at...
knowing such reporter...
Well, it's concerning an official. Which one? No, that's... You see, that's why I don't think it's a false report to the police. And we prosecute that, and I would never prosecute a false report. That's the circumstance where you call up and say, you know, my girlfriend punched me. That's a fictitious report to a police. It's not
right,
an answer to a question.
That's fine. It says any false information. But, right, I don't know if there's any clarifying case law that would decide whether any false information would include
right.
My name is Richard Schmeckle when I'm not actually Richard Schmeckle. It might not.
All right. Well, good. Again, the main point is we don't want to drop this. There will
right.
be some sort of liability hook for it, exactly how and at what level will be decided.
Yeah,
just striking that. For those of you listening in, there's some dramatic page turning going on
I'll raise something.
I'm
just slipping through. Do you have anything else in nine?
Both of you had a lot of very helpful comments, and you know, at this point, particularly with we're not it's still just Dawn and Mike on the phone. So you know,
I don't have.
If there are points that are particularly helpful to flesh out now, because look, honestly, we're gonna get your comments.
Yeah,
we're gonna go over it all together as a group once everybody's seen everybody's. And at that point, there are usually some that we can very productively kind of talk through, and folks are just in different positions. Is there anything more particularly at that level of, here's, a kind of a tricky drafting place that I felt like wasn't quite right? Because thinking that through together can often be very productive. We have a very different, policy to take, but kind of an intermediate places. Is there anything like that which might be good to have your guys' heads on the same page?
So in 10, and I've mentioned this to you before, Richard. This is my all the ID number and whether it's the vehicle or the part. And here's my concern. Because the penalty has to do with the value, right? So you alter an ID number, and then the penalty is about the value of the vehicle or the part. And my concern is that I alter the number of the part, really intending to hide the part, but it's in a car already. And I do not want to be penalized for the value of the entire
car
when really what I've done is the part.
Okay.
I want it to be that if I intend the part, then that's what I... That's...
Yeah, and
Well, the question is, what is meant by the part? Because it's one thing to change the number on the engine block.
Mm-hmm.
And it's another thing to change the actual number of the vehicle itself. And I would, if it's the vehicle itself's part, which is usually that upper front left-hand corner, then I think the value of the vehicle makes sense. It shouldn't be the value of the dashboard that it happens to be cemented to. But I agree with Laura that if we're talking about the engine block, we should be discussing the value of the engine block.
Right.
I will say probably also this number is too low. Right? Anyone who's ever gotten in any little ding of a fender bender and they're well, that's connected to the blah, 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 and that's $5,000.
Yeah.
There is no part of a car that's... So...
I think in the chop shop kind of situation, it might be parts and labor, is that line item. But, I hear you.
Work through the hypo of changing the VIN on a part of a still fully
right,
assembled
not, right,
car.
Right, I'm not trying to value the little tag that is the VIN, right? Like,
yeah,
I'm not...
Right.
But
that's the danger on the
that's
other side.
Yeah, that's
right,
what I want
to
avoid.
Right, to
yeah,
do
yeah,
that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But it is still like, am I hiding the car or am I hiding the part?
Right.
Right? Even if I do the little label, I'm not trying to ask you to value the little label on the car. I'm clearly doing it because I'm trying to hide the car.
My sense of it, though, is it doesn't come up that often. Where I've seen this, it's already been chopped.
Right.
So the engine
block's
already removed from
exactly,
the vehicle, and without
exactly,
talking about it, anything else
it's
other than that
just a
engine
part,
that's sitting in the guy's backyard,
right,
which has a VIN number that's been obliterated
right,
or removed.
Right.
Right. Would, right, and we talked about a remove.
Yeah, yeah. Would discussion in the commentary be sufficient, do you think? Or is this at a level where you still feel like this, the statutory language just
I don't know. I mean, you got in fact there. Right? And part of what I'm talking about is has to I don't how do we solve this, right? Because Dave is going to be right sometimes that the part, sometimes, not that
not often,
but every once in a while, it will be the part was altered, but it's really about the car. That's fair. But sometimes it really might be the part was the part. And I so I feel like it's an intent thing, and that this sort of saying, I forget the in fact, because once we figure out which
right,
thing
right,
we're valuing,
right,
it's not the in fact of how much it costs. It's which is the thing we're valuing, mm-hmm, and how do we unpack which of those? It's here with the intent to conceal, and then it is. Is that, so maybe it is in the explanation, which is whichever you have the intent to conceal is the thing you need to value.
Yeah, this is a little odd. So the hypothetical here, you alter a VIN on a part, the car is still assembled. It's not in a chop shop. It's like still there.
You've bought it. You've bought it. You bought from Dave's chop shop the blah, blah, blah part that you just needed to refurbish your fabulous Mustang, blah, blah, blah. Right? It's not your car. It's the part.
Right.
I don't want you to end up with the whole car valued when clearly what was hidden was the part that you didn't want any of us to figure out that part was stolen. Mm.
Is the VIN... Aren't VINs a very specific regulatory thing? Like, vehicle identification numbers are, like, a very specific... I mean, can we just cross-define it?
Well, except we're not talking, so we don't mean VIN. I'm saying VIN, but it's not VIN. There's an ID number on the car.
And that's actually a separate...
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Oh.
But that is actually an interesting problem, because the VIN, I think, is defined as the motor vehicle.
Yes.
Not the part. And so we may need to rephrase the gradation sections anyhow.
I'm sorry. My understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, but like that the VIN, which identifies the vehicle as a whole, is actually sometimes in various places on a vehicle. There's a prominent one that's easily accessible, usually right up near the driver's area, in the door area, kind of up front. But it can be in other places on the vehicle, including, I think I read something like...
On the chassis itself.
On the chassis,
right,
and sometimes even like on the block or something, like someplace that is actually hard to reach otherwise, right? For, to enhance law enforcement. So the VIN, as it were, is... multiple places identifying it as a car, and it may be on the same part, you know, a section of the chassis or something like this, or the dashboard, as another part number, a manufacturer part number, which is also quite possible, you know, tagged in a system, you know, some database somewhere, and is traceable, right? And so you would, so a given part might have the VIN on it, and the that particular part ID number from the manufacturer, and again, all of this can happen in multiple places in the car. So it's like it's kind of I don't know. There's not just like one. There's one VIN, but it can be in multiple places and obliterated in multiple. So
but regardless, our ID number definition would cover both of those.
Yeah,
right.
Should,
it's just that's the you're reading it in the penalty, but it's just because that's the name of the thing.
But I think you're right about the.
No, I was reading first degree altering vehicle identification number,
Right, the title, the title.
The title of the
So yeah, okay. Maybe that is something actually.
Yeah, maybe you should change it so it's not a term of art.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So we have three scenarios, right? We've got I am driving the whole car, where VINs are taken care of. Mm. Dave has the chop shop where right. It's parts. There are already parts, and Janu has the legitimate car with the part in it.
Right. And I have obliterated, altered that.
With an obliterated, right, exactly.
And so, right, so to be guilty, right, you have to show, right, intent to hide the identity
of the
vehicle.
No, but we have to show that he altered it.
Well,
not merely that he was driving a car that.
Well, right, but even assume I bought a part from
right,
secondary
because,
market
because
and
your top shop is very good.
Number.
Or whatever, right? He sort of realizes,
right,
like, oh shit, right.
I do
however it.
It
works.
It's true. I think maybe to rework the Pound revisions, because then, right, you'd find us guilty of the theory that, well, you had the intent to hide the identity, not of the whole car, because otherwise the car was mine and I had it. But yeah, that one engine block or that one piece, for whatever reason, I bought from the secondary market, scraped off the ID number.
So then it's sort of committing the offense and the value of the motor vehicle or vehicle part that was intended to conceal.
So you're in that hypo. So it seems like right in that hypo, if I'm driving my own classic Mustang and I have some cheap part and I've altered the ID on that part to then put in, the appropriate value should be the part, not my whole classic Mustang.
Right, exactly.
Right? I think that's not considered that. So that might just be involved with us.
I mean, it probably like
reworking
happens
the,
once
yeah.
in
the penalty
a
provision.
30 or whatever. But right, that's it, right? It is. It's the value of the thing you
that
intended
was.
To conceal.
That was intended,
which
right.
probably isn't that hard, because it's usually I've got the car that is the problem, or you've got
the
chop shop. It's probably not.
Yeah, I put it in brackets up here. It's maybe not the most elegant way, but that kind of thing. Laura, is that on screen the red? That's what just that was intended to be. That's
yeah,
where you're okay.
Like that. All
right.
And now I want it in the next thing for the bikes.
Yeah,
yeah.
No, hold on.
Yeah,
but I think number A4 is what. Is another way to approach it, because that may be doing something to lift it, right? With intent to identify the motor vehicle or a motor vehicle part. Mm-hmm. So there may be a way to separate it.
Yeah, sure,
there as
sure.
Well.
We'll see if we can find a cleaner way. But and again, yeah, whatever it is here, bicycle would be the same thing. So agreed
yeah.
on that. So good. Well, we'll take another look at that. See if we can come up with.
Yeah. But with bicycle, we just didn't create it though, so it won't.
So it doesn't even
it
matter.
It won't really matter.
Okay.
Yeah. I figured bikes
okay.
are
okay.
not.
Yeah. Although maybe not. I don't know how much.
No,
how much
no,
should
no,
be?
There are pricey bikes out there.
No.
I mean,
good.
Are these like $1,000?
Some of the
things?
Cars that are out there for the most
part are about $1,400.
Okay.
And all the other green ones are about $100 a pop.
$100.
Wait, so which ones are $1,400?
The electric ones with
the electric ones. I was gonna say,
but those are nothing compared with some of the street bikes or mountain bikes that the stores sell.
But my guess is you
no, sure,
that's
crazy.
Filled in some gap of a definition of motor vehicle that's going to get your electric bike. There's a lot of filling in gaps.
Yep, gaps and overlap. Gaps and overlap. That's when we.
Electric bikes, yeah.
Good.
Power.
Anything else? And again, I'm not pressuring people to come up with things, but. Feel free to mention it in your comments too. I mean, like, it doesn't hurt, like makes right. We will proceed to tweak this, but like I think it's also helpful to preserve the record and just you know It's another.
Shows your
did your homework. You know, show your work. Isn't that? Yeah, you know, it's my daughter has that. You know, show your work. Good for now, Dave. Or
yeah, I don't have
else
anything
discuss?
Else that I think we need to debate.
Okay.
At this point, I mean, I'm still working on the memo.
Sure. Sure.
Yeah, I'm good. I mean, I'm not. But yeah, it's good. It's good. It's good.
Okay. Anything more? Don, anything you wanted to raise? Don number one or Don number two? Hopefully we have...
No. Yep.
All right. Good, good. Kate, was this mildly instructive at least?
This was pain.
It varies, but yeah. We've been working on this cluster of property funds for a bit, so there's already been a...
No, it's good. I usually see this play out on the other side.
I was going to say, so this is actually more sane, hopefully a sane way of developing law than sometimes happens. But great. Well, let's go ahead and call me in, and thank you all.
Yay.
Hey.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye, Michael. Thank you, Don. Appreciate it.
All right. Have a good one, guys. Thanks.
All right.